opportunity with the expiration of the UN resolution that they can now act again against Iran. But we're seeing clearly that the international community does not support this action.
At least 28 Palestinians have been killed in the Gaza Strip since a ceasefire between Hamas and the Israeli regime went into effect. In one of the deadliest strikes, 11 members of a single family, including several children, were killed in Gaza City's Zaytun neighborhood. The Hamas resistance movement condemned the attack, saying it shows Israel's premeditated intent to target defenseless civilians. It called the massacre another violation of the recently agreed-upon ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, Gaza's health officials say nearly 170,000 patients urgently need surgical procedures, but hospitals lack the equipment and facilities to treat them. The death toll from the U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza since October 2023 has surged to nearly 68,000. Let us now cross over to Deir al-Balah in Gaza and get an update from Ghada Ibrahim, the underground Ghada. Over to you.
By the ceasefire's enforcement more than a week ago, the violations of the Israeli regime continued on the expense of the Palestinians here at the Gaza Strip. We are talking about at least 29 Palestinians killed since the beginning of the ceasefire more than a week ago. And this actually is non-stop as more people are now trying to reach to their areas, to reach to their to the areas the Israeli occupation withdrew from. However, only to be met with the Israeli gunfire, direct shooting, the drones attacks, and also the tank shelling that is continuous until this moment. We are from now, from a time and another, we are still hearing the shooting from the Israeli tanks towards the eastern bars of the city of Deir al-Balah, of Khan Yunis, and all the areas like Ash-Shuja'iyya neighborhood, Az-Zaytun neighborhood, and these areas that are in the east of Salah al-Din Street. The Israeli occupation army keeps violating the ceasefire agreement, keeps killing and using the lethal force and the lethal violence against the Palestinians who are trying to go back to their areas. The Israeli occupation army is protecting that these people are crossing the yellow line, the invisible, actually, yellow line, and asking the people here while walking in the street, do you know what is the yellow line? People do not know there exists or actually a yellow line. They don't know what is the yellow line and where it is, where this yellow line is. So many people are going to their areas, going normally to return to their still standing neighborhoods and still standing houses, only to be met with the direct gunfire and the direct shooting from the Israeli from the Israeli tanks and from the Israeli snipers and tanks near these areas. This again highlights how the Israeli occupation army has altered to use this yellow line as another death trap for the Palestinians again, in order like to keep killing them and to mass kill the people in these areas. And the last of these massacres was against Abu Sha'ban family, and that resulted in the killing of 11 of the same family, while the rest were injured very critically. And the Israeli army has previously protected that these, they already targeted a cell of Palestinians trying to dig a tunnel in the east of Az-Zaytun area. However, with no further details, actually, the killed people in this attack were actually children. 7 of them were children and at least one woman. So the Israeli occupation army is lying again about targeting the Palestinians in these areas and about this a newly improvised death trap in the eastern parts of Gaza City. And again, the search for the corpses and the search for the dead corpses of the captives continue and is underway, particularly in the northern parts of Khan Yunis City. Earlier this night, the Palestinian faction has already handed over a corpse of a 75-year-old captive that was actually buried under the rubble of a tunnel in the north of Khan Yunis City. The work is underway. Many are expected to be buried under the same area. However, the circumstances are really challenging as the Palestinians here and the civil defense workers here are working with the minimum capabilities. They don't have equipment, they don't have heavy machinery, and also they don't have the fuel required for these heavy machinery, you know, they like to dig further for the dead bodies and the corpses buried under the rubble of these areas. And this again highlights another kind of brings to the service, another kind of the double standards of the world about only caring about the 18 corpses of the Israelis buried under the rubble of Gaza. However, at the same time, we have more than 10,000 Palestinians still buried under the rubble of the destroyed neighborhoods and buildings in Gaza City. More than 55 million tons of rubble were created and piled up by the Israeli war or by the Israeli genocide against the Gaza Strip, and that is actually very challenging.
Right, thank you so much, Gada, for the update. That was Gada Ibrahim joining us from Deir al-Balah. The UN World Food Programme urges increased capacity at Gaza's aid crossings, faster truck clearance, and the opening of additional routes for quicker delivery of aid to the Palestinians in urgent need.
I think we need more capacity at the crossings, especially with getting more truck scanning, processing the incoming supplies. The faster we can move aid in, the more lives we can reach quickly. We can pull communities back from the brink of famine. I think the ceasefire has opened a narrow window of opportunity, and WFP is moving very quickly and swiftly to scale up food assistance and reach families who have endured months of blockade, displacement, and
the agency's spokeswoman added that since the ceasefire began, WFP has delivered an average of 560 tons of food per day into Gaza. However, she noted that it still falls short of meeting the needs of people across the strip. Meanwhile, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees is sounding the alarm over soaring food prices in Gaza. In a statement, UNRWA attributed the spike to Israel's destruction and seizure of agricultural lands in Gaza. The agency added that nearly all farmland in Gaza is now either destroyed or inaccessible. UNRWA emphasized that this has left families without income and pushed food prices to unprecedented levels. Moving to the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians continue to suffer from Israeli violence, the regime forces have carried out yet another large-scale raid in the occupied Palestinian territories. Attacks included incursions into Ramallah, Nablus, Al-Quds, and Jenin, among others. Israeli forces abducted several Palestinians while firing tear gas and throwing stun grenades. For more on this, we were earlier joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Naka Hamad.
It is a loop of violence on the occupied territories to the north of Ramallah, the village of Kulbar. Since the hours of the morning, the Israeli forces interfered and started shooting live ammunition and started shooting tear gas bombs and detained many of those Palestinians who were just trying to reach out towards their land and towards their olive groves. The same situation happened today in the village of Deir Ammar to the northwest of Ramallah, where the Israeli forces have also attacked the Palestinians, attacked the volunteers. Among them were international activists and helped them.
Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have once again taken to the streets in nationwide rallies to express their solidarity with Palestine and pay tribute to resistance leaders killed by Israel. Our correspondent Yusuf Mari tells us more from Sana'a.
The masses took to the streets in another Friday demonstration to commemorate the leaders who have been martyred in the 2 years of Israeli aggression against Muslim nations. In Sana'a, protesters commemorated Major General Mohammed Al-Ghamadi, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike last month.
We came out to say that we are sacrificing our leaders for martyrdom in the path of Allah. The blood of these martyrs paves the way for victory for the Islamic world. It has already granted victory and honor to the Palestinians and lifted the siege against Gaza.
Protesters also praised the Palestinian people for achieving a historic victory against the Israeli regime. In 2 years of Palestinian resistance, many leaders fell, including Yahya Sinwar, who was martyred while fighting until his very last breath.
We are here to congratulate the Palestinians on their victory and to praise their patience and steadfastness. You have proven to the world that you will never forsake your land and your cause. We will remain with you all the way.
For Yemenis, many more battles are still ahead, and Yemen will be prepared for another round against Israel.
Our motto is, if they resume their attacks, we will return with our punishments. We tell our brothers in Gaza and our brothers across the world that we will continue with our fight against tyranny and oppression, and we will remain on this path to sacrifice our blood for the sake of Allah.
As Israel continues its war crimes across West Asia, Yemenis say Israel will pay a heavy price sooner or later. But how does Yemen plan on making Israel pay? Yemeni military officials have hinted at the revelation of new precision missiles that Israeli anti-missile systems will have no answer for.
Yemenis here believe that the country's armed forces should continue to develop and manufacture precision missiles, which they believe should be used to deter the Israeli regime from continuing its acts of aggression against the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
Human rights advocates are raising the alarm over the violent treatment of 22-year-old political prisoner Mohammed Omar Khalid, who is currently being held on remand at a prison in London. Omar is accused of participating in a protest that targeted Israel's arms manufacturer Elbit Systems. Our reporter Latifa Abu Chalka reports.
Inside Wormwood Scrubs, Mohammed Omar Khalid is facing what supporters describe as religious persecution and state retaliation for his political beliefs. The 22-year-old was arrested on the 1st of August and has since been held without trial after being accused of taking part in direct action against Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons producer. His protest targeted the UK's ongoing military ties to Israel, which, in addition to supplying weapons, has also collected surveillance intelligence over Gaza at the expense of the UK taxpayer.
Being a former political prisoner, I understand the repression that comes inside prison and how political prisoners are specifically targeted. There's an extra layer to this, of course, since the prescription of Palestine Action. This has brought a whole new level of repression and violence against political prisoners.
While in custody, Omar reports that he has been harassed by prison officers for performing the adhan, the Muslim call to prayer. On October 7th, after refusing to stop his recitation, officers allegedly placed him in a chokehold, stripped him by force, and left him bruised and injured, all without medical care.
Despite being beaten and forcibly strip searched, Omar says in his statement that he knows that he could do more for Palestine and that he has never tasted freedom until now.
British media and politicians have been accused of interfering in the administration of justice by publicly commenting on the Filton 24 case, which has impacted their treatment while in remand.
They have been treated and labelled as high-risk prisoners. They have been called terrorists from the staff from inside the prison. And they've not allowed or enabled services to other prisoners across the network.
The assault, coupled with his placement in solitary confinement, has sparked outrage amongst human rights observers and faith communities.
It's our duty to come here to support him, because the way that they treated him, the way that they oppressed him, in the way that they persecuted him, is not tolerated in any way, shape or form. And what we need to do is to stand firm with him, because just as they try to lower his honour, he'll be also elevated, just like the prisoners in Palestine.
It appears that Britain's so-called counter-terror framework has crossed the line into criminalizing conscience, faith, and the right to resist war. Latifa Abu Shara, London.
17 people have been killed in a Pakistani airstrike in Afghanistan's Paktika province in what Kabul describes as a violation of a recently extended ceasefire. The strike targeted a busy market in Argun, just days after both sides agreed to halt hostilities and prepare for peace talks in Doha. Pakistani officials confirmed the cross-border attack, but claimed it was a precision strike against the Hafez Gul Bahadur group, a local faction of Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. Islamabad says the group was behind a deadly suicide bombing against Pakistani troops in North Waziristan earlier this week. Security sources say at least 100 Afghan militants have been killed in the past 48 hours. This comes as high-level negotiations between the two countries are set to begin Saturday in Qatar. You U.S. President Donald Trump has cautioned that giving Ukraine long-range Tomahawk missiles could cause a significant escalation in the war with Russia.
They're an amazing weapon. They're a very powerful weapon, but they're a very dangerous weapon, and it could mean big escalation. It could mean a lot of bad things can happen. Tomahawks are a big deal, but one thing I have to say, we want Tomahawks also.
Trump made the remarks in a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky in the White House. He emphasized that the United States is reluctant to supply the powerful Tomahawk cruise missiles as it considers them a critical asset for its own defense needs. The Ukrainian president suggested that Kyiv could provide drones to the U.S. in exchange for the missiles. Russia has repeatedly warned the U.S. against the provision of Tomahawks that would represent a substantial escalation in the conflict. The Tomahawk missiles, which have a range of nearly 2,000 kilometers, are capable of striking targets at considerable distances. And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to RIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad. I'm the host of this show. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, that is very influential, and we can learn many lessons from that. Imam Khomeini says, firstly, the Islamic precepts contain diverse laws and regulations which form a general social order. This juristic order covers all which are needed by man, as from being sociable with the neighbors, one's children, tribe, relatives, citizens, personal affairs, marital life, up to the regulations for war and peace, international relations, penal code, commercial, industrial, and agricultural rights. Islam is a religion of government. It wants to govern the life of human beings. Okay? So, when we have so many laws, like what should we do with a person who steals? How should we punish a person who has committed murder, who has killed someone else? How we should punish those who have, I don't know, who have drunk alcohol or wine in public and things like that. All of this shows that it's within a government. The laws of Islam are to be enforced within a government, okay? No one disagrees that Islam, at the time of the Prophet, was not just, a personal religion that had nothing to do with politics. It was indeed a political religion. Prophet Muhammad, when he established the government in Medina, and later on he expanded, it expanded to cover the whole of the Arabian Peninsula. This is how governments are formed, right? So it was political. Some think that, oh, politics is a negative thing and Islam should have nothing to do with it. That's not true. Politics, the word politics and political affairs, has this negative connotation these days, like in recent days. But it doesn't mean that we have to be detached from politics as Muslims, and that Islam should not be like, it should not have any say in politics, especially since we are in the age of the occultation of Imam Mahdi. No, that's not the case. We need to form a government. We have to rise up against all of the wrongdoers, all of the tyrants of the world.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day. selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Selection of Ayatollah Khomeini's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran. Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
It is He who has sent His apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that He may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. Despite being severely visually impaired, Samahar Al-Naji managed to live a normal life. She knew every nook and corner of her home and didn't need to see to function optimally. Surrounded by her husband and sons, she found some comfort in the occupied land, despite the constant threats and harassment from the IOF. But she lost all that in the ongoing genocide being perpetrated by the Zionist regime on Gaza. Losing her husband and being constantly displaced from one place to another, she says it's hard to mentally map out her ever-changing surroundings. Her sons, meanwhile, suffer from seizures and anxiety due to the constant fear as their bodies are consumed by rashes due to the constant insect bites that take over the tents in summer. Here is the story of Samaha.
Palestinians have always lived in service to others, regardless of their personal circumstances. A desire to do for others has often helped this community at the very worst of times. Being visually impaired at the best of times under Israeli occupation would be a struggle, but Samer tried to live a life, a full life, despite the challenges. She would need that resilience for the darker days ahead. Samer recounts an example of some of the injustices suffered at the hands of Israel during this time and the lessons in defiance that were taught by her family, especially her mother. Samer and her family knew that one of the best weapons at her disposal was education. Existing in the midst of a genocide is a life or death struggle. Now imagine that fight with a pronounced disability, without a husband's protection, and with children deeply impacted and likely suffering from severe PTSD. There seems a deliberate cruelty in the ways in which the disabled and vulnerable are treated now. The genocide has made existing obstacles nigh on impossible to overcome and added an additional layer of inhumanity that makes life almost unbearable. There is a powerful Palestinian rebuke of the Western plans for Gaza. The unrelenting grind of life is only made bearable with God's grace. The litany of issues Samer and her boys must wrestle with each day reads almost like a horror novel. For Palestinians like Samer, the concept of Arab unity is dead and buried like Gazans under the rubble. For Palestinians to have a fighting chance, there has to be a coming together of the Ummah. Samer's story is sadly not unique. The Western-backed Israeli genocide has cost Palestinians so much, and it's a debt that the world can never truly repay. But perhaps we can begin the process of atonement by listening carefully to what Samer has to say.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Samer's struggles is Aveline McCorgan, an activist with the Spartacist League, a Marxist group. Welcome, Aveline.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Sakina.
You're most welcome. Aveline, you know, every woman and man, any child in Gaza today is going through a really difficult situation. But, you know, Samer's problems are compounded by the fact that she's blind. And not just that, but, you know, if we the stories of her children, the trauma they are living through, you know, having seizures because of the things that they see. You know, when this is over, if at all they survive the genocide, you know, are these children scarred forever? What kind of a generation are we looking at in the future?
Thank you. Very good question. She's obviously an extraordinary woman, and I think the courage and determination that she shows, in spite of all the obstacles, is symbolic of the struggle of the whole Palestinian nation to survive, to refuse to be written out of history by the genocidal war of Israel. So, and I think her courage is a very good illustration of what drives the Palestinian national liberation struggle. And I'm glad you mentioned the youth and the trauma that they suffer, which is unimaginable. But also your question points to the future. And I think the most important thing there is to draw the political lessons. If I may mention Northern Ireland, I grew up in Ireland, and although the armed struggle ended there in 1998, the young generation still experiences trauma of a struggle that they did not even live through. And I think there's a lesson there. The lesson is that as long as the national oppression exists, Britain's not driven out of Northern Ireland, as long as the national oppression of the Palestinians exists, that trauma will not go away. If I may mention something for your viewers in Iran, there was a lot of sympathy for the Irish struggle in Iran, and in the early 1980s, they renamed a street in Tehran for Bobby Sands, who's a hero of the Irish national struggle. I believe it was a street that ran very near to where the British embassy was. So that was nice.
Absolutely, and I know Iranians have supported the cause of liberations and justice throughout the world, really. At the moment, you know, they are paying the price. We just saw the 12-day war that happened, illegal war. The Lebanese, the Yemenis, you know, have paid the price for supporting, you know, the cause of justice. But on the other hand, you know, Samahar talks about the fact that their neighbors, their brothers, the Arab nations, you know, they don't see them. The reality is that they see them, but they close their eyes to their plight. I mean, UAE, we've just heard recently, has condemned the Palestinian attack on, you know, the settlers, the Israelis, who are actually the occupiers, but they don't see what is happening in Gaza. What is possessing them, these Arabs?
Let me just say, first of all, since you mentioned the war on Iran, my organization, in the Palestine demonstration in London, immediately after that war, our banner said, stand with Iran and Palestine, because many groups on the left here did not stand with it even under that attack. Okay, but to your broader question, it's a very good question. What about the Arab regimes? And I think the same question also applies to the axis of resistance. And so to answer the question, I just want to zoom out a little bit to what is the overall global situation there. American imperialism is top dog, dominates the world. Israel is the armed fist of American imperialism in the region. And part of what they do, in addition to the genocide of the Palestinians, the overall effect is they set the peoples of that region against each other, divided along religious lines, Shia versus Sunni, ethnic lines, and so on. And those regimes that you rightly point the finger at, their priority is always to protect their own power base, to maintain themselves in power, to maintain stability in their own countries, and that puts them against the interests of the masses in their own countries, and the support of the Palestinians is never their priority. Now, similar thing can be said about the movement in the West, but my point is, a winning strategy for the Palestinians, we think, should look to the masses of those countries to rise up in a mighty struggle against those regimes, against imperialism, and against Israel, as opposed to looking to...
Absolutely, you couldn't have said it better. I've been very interested, you know, how you've described the situation in the Middle East and, you know, the different factions and what they stand for. Let's come here to, you know, to the West now, you know, we're in Britain, in the belly of the beast, so to say,
yes,
because we created the occupation in the first place.
Yes.
We see a UK that is in shambles right now. I think anybody can accept that, you know.
Yes.
The government will be going, you know, reshuffling because of corruption scandals. We thought we were in the past, you know, with the Tory government. It's becoming fascist, or maybe it's always been fascist. But do you think the curtains on October 7th have been lifted and we are seeing the West for what it truly is?
I think certainly the momentum within Britain is driving to the right. And I think the key question for is, there's been huge support for Palestine, for example, in Britain. And, you know, massive demonstrations. We have participated in those demonstrations, but always under our own banners. So why, in spite of all those demonstrations for almost 2 years now, is the momentum, why is the direction of motion going to the right? And why have the demonstrations, the mass support for the Palestinian cause, not been turned into an opposition to the Starmer government, which is has been arming the genocide? And part of the problem with that, we think, is political. The pro-Palestine movement is very much tied to liberalism, which is tied to the established order, the British political establishment. And the British political establishment is a lackey of American imperialism, and so it's a red line for the British ruling class that you must support Zionist State of Israel in everything that it does. Mm-hmm. So
how do we get out of this? Can we ever get out of it?
Yes, we can get out of this, but it is a challenge. For example, a new party has been declared in Britain by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana, formerly Labour members of Parliament. For that party to succeed, we think that a number of things must happen. First of all, they must ditch liberalism, break with liberalism. They must turn to the working class. It is in the interest of the working class to fight against British imperialism. They are the force that can do it. But the left, and including the Corbyn movement of the past, has alienated the working class. So we think they must be organized as a force that will win the working class. And on the question of Palestine, they must clearly say no to Zionism, you know, within the new party.
Absolutely, there is no room for that at all, especially in this time. But actually, very quickly, we are almost out of time. You're talking of the working class. Your organization fights for the working class. Very briefly, tell me, you know, what is it that you do, and how are you linked to the Palestinian activism?
We seek to rebuild the socialist and communist movement on a solid political foundation against imperialism, against Zionism, and against the ruling class, whether in the Middle East, but also here. And that means drawing a lot of lessons from the past, from the failures of the past, and, you know, putting forward a strategy for now, for a strategy to win.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so fascinating for me, you know, when I hear people from such different political, cultural, religious, you know, outlooks, but at the same time, from whichever angle we are coming at, it's a common cause of justice, you know, against imperialism and fighting for the humanity of people like those of Palestinians. Thank you so much, Evelyn. I really appreciate you being with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Until next time, goodbye.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans of the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on September 20th, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. One achievement was that the Iranian nation discovered the greatness of its capabilities. Consider the younger ladies and gentlemen who came and spoke here today. They keep saying that we should apply and use the techniques used during the imposed war, the sacred defense, and the administration and management of the country, in the economy and in other such areas. What does this mean? It means that during the sacred defense, the capabilities of the Iranian nation were seen so clearly that everyone wants to follow those approaches in all sections of the management of the country, the development of the country, and the growth of the country. In other words, the sacred defense brought an image in front of the Iranian nation that allowed it to recognize itself. What we were told throughout history and the way we were treated was the opposite of this. During the period of the Qajar and during the period of the Pahlavi, it was continuously instilled in us that we can't, that we aren't anyone important, that we aren't worthy of anything, and that the world powers are able to wipe us off the face of the earth with one motion. This is what we were taught. They had always told us that we should learn from them, that we should follow them, and that we should ask them for things. The sacred defense showed us otherwise. It showed us that those very people whom some still depend on and pin their hopes on join forces and take action against our nation, but can't do a damn thing. The sacred defense showed the Iranian nation this. So, we discovered our own capabilities. We realized that a young man like Martyr Hassan Bagheri, not to mention those who are alive, as we have plenty of similar people who are still alive, gets up and goes to the battlefields and becomes a strategist in a short period of time. In other words, he becomes a defense and war strategist. Is such a capability a joke? Where was this talent? Martyr Hassan Bagheri was a young man. He was a newspaper reporter. He wrote articles for the Jumhuriya Islami newspaper. This talent flourished. We have thousands of similar examples of such talent, such as talent in construction.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. From Tehran, a warm greetings to each and every one of you, dear listeners. Welcome to Iran Radio, your daily source of inspiration and reflection. Broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Together, we'll explore moments of faith, seek knowledge, and share stories that bridge hearts across the distances. So whenever you are at home, on the road, or taking a quiet moment, stay with us. A rich tapestry of voices, insights, and culture awaits you. First up, we have today's special. This daily program is a vibrant fusion of faith and culture, exploring various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Get ready for a rich tapestry of Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, inspiring nasheeds, insightful reports, and so much more. Then get ready to listen to the hadith of the day. Sheikh Muhammad Jafar Danish shares a profound hadith from the Holy Prophet and his revered family, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. You'll get a brief explanation and commentary, often trying into significant dates on your lunar or solar calendars. It's a moment of reflection you'll carry with you throughout the day. Next, tune in for another captivating segment from our very own Iran Radio's productions. Following that, it's time for Let's Recite the Quran. This program draws you closer to the Holy Book, guiding you through eloquent recitation at level 2. We'll explore tajweed points through a compare and match method, applying them to the beautiful verses of the final surahs of the Holy Quran. Today's special, we'll be back later, so stick around.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam, dear friend. Inshallah, you are doing well, and thank you for choosing this program to listen to. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Come with us because we're going to speak about the concept of a word. Nomophobia means the fear of being without your phone. So be with us.